Welcome to the In Pursuit of Luxury Live, Season 10 of the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast. And for this season, we're focusing on the amazing live discussions we had at the In Pursuit of Luxury conference in June of 2025. The title of the conference was Honest Luxury. And this, the first of two episodes, we are featuring extraordinary guests, including Dame Zandra Rhodes, Maria Grushvogel, Richard McVettis, and Piers Atkinson.
Morning, everybody, and welcome. This is our seventh In Pursuit of Luxury conference, the first at Ravensbourne University. And it's been a very brief introduction. It's been quite a journey for us. For Veronica and I have been working on this for, 10, 12 years now. And things have been changing quite a lot. And the aim has increasingly focused on really redefining ideas of luxury and what it might mean, and hopefully disrupting the conversation a bit, because we've all heard and spoken about ad nauseum branding and luxury brands and, you know, ideas of exclusivity and bespoke. And you see advertising that implies something that it's not really. And today's conference is really about being honest. And our guests, Dame Zandra Rhodes, Piers Atkinson, Maria Grushvogel, Richard McVettis, I've spoken to over the years and feel that they have this notion of honesty that's inherent in their work. And hence the title of our first talk is Honest Luxury. So I'm going to start by asking our panel, or welcoming our panel, firstly, and asking what they think honesty means, just as a word. So I'll start with let's start with Maria.
Of course you have to start with me.
This is not rehearsed, by the way. They don't have any questions.
So honesty, I mean, as a word, honesty is really, really about being true and really about truth. So I think in the context of honest luxury, it's really about expressing the truth of what a luxury should be. And I think nowadays the greatest luxury is time. So that's time that's taken to make something, to consider the design, all the way right through to the time saved actually by great design. Because great design, if you have something that's beautifully designed, it's going to last a long time. You're going to treasure it. You're going to enjoy it. And it's in all areas, therefore, luxury for me is time.
Zandra, what about you?
Well, about honesty itself.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose it's selling a product that I personally handled and that has been made by hand and I suppose designed within my studio. So I'm selling a product that has started with me and finishes with me before it goes to the customer.
Yeah. Amazing. Piers?
I think honesty can apply to looking inwards. So looking inwards is being true to yourself, like that truth, and in being true about how we want to design or make or use our craftsmanship. And then honesty in thinking about our clients is, I would say, transparency. And that's an important word, I think, in fashion, and provenance and transparency. So I think it's lovely I was talking to these two fabulous designers earlier and they were talking about their methods of working and designing in a small way, like I do with my hats, and producing clothes that you know exactly who's made it and how it's been made and where it's been made. So that transparency for the client, I think, is a modern need and a modern luxury.
Richard, what about you?
Yeah, I agree with all of that, basically. I think time absolutely is something I think I truly treasure. And it's one of those resources that all of us have a limited limited amount of. So that for me is really important. And especially when we think about time as being a luxurious item, because you can buy other people's time, of course, but you have a very limited aspect of that. And I think honesty, is about truth. Truth to yourself, I agree. And this idea of transparency, I think, is really important.
So each of you works in quite distinct ways, Sandra, with the way you design. I mean, that's an interesting process because you don't use a computer. And I've seen your studio and how amazing it is. I mean, I'm amazed you can find anything, but it's amazing how your design process is amazing. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, considering that I've been designing and creating for about, I suppose, 70 years, frightening, really. But, I'm really a print designer, a textile print designer that had to find a job. And no one would buy my prints, so I ended up teaching and setting up my own printing company. And then when I found there other people couldn't work out how to use my prints, I then thought, I'll print and then I'll make the garments. So I got in a machinist and someone to show me how to make the garments. And it really progressed from there. I mean, now it's a lot of cataloguing and going back. Piers also is the head of my foundation. And so we're now sort of like putting all the treasures together and working out what's going to happen to them for posterity. We had a big sale at Kerry Taylor's auction house yesterday with a few that we decided to part with.
And what about you, Piers?
Can you remind me of the question, please?
Just about process.
In terms of my design process. So
design, making.
So I'm beginning to feel a bit old-fashioned because I still design in collections. Again, we were talking a bit about this before, is that there's this constant stream of product, or we feel as designers or creators to produce this constant stream of product going out there. And when you put collections together, they tended to be kind of based on seasons, I suppose, so summer hats and straw and winter hats and felt. And I still like to work with that because I like to explore certain ideas, and that can change. It might be, so my last collection was about making DIY crowns because I wanted people to feel like they could crown themselves. But I was also looking a bit at Donald Trump and how he's crowning himself. So I sort of wanted to make them out of cardboard or paint them, boiler suit orange or workman jacket orange or yellow. So I was exploring kind of ideas about crowning yourself. But other times I might want to just explore with a fabric or a range of colours. So I have a topic that I want to explore and experiment with. And they tend to... I love the fact you've got all this film behind. So when I did the cherries, for example, I was looking at those 80s airbrush posters that you could get in Athena if you're a teenager like me in the 80s. And it would have lips with honey or hummingbirds. Yeah, remember? And big cherries with sort of glossy cherries. So that's what I was doing in that period. So yes, I have a theme that I want to explore and materials I want to explore, I think generally. I get bored quite quickly, so I like to experiment.
I get bored quite quickly as well. Richard, you work in a completely different way. I'm surprised you can see most of what you're embroidering, but tell us about your process.
Yeah, so I mean, if no one knows about my work, many of my pieces are informed by hand embroidery. So I work primarily with hand stitch, so which speaks of time in itself. So actually there's a real commitment to labor and time within my work. It's really all about the majesty of the hand and that investment of time in very ordinary materials. So lots of dots, lots of lines, lots of crosses, all of these sort of in multiples and repetition. An enduring obsession, I would say. And some of my work actually goes against this idea of faster and cheaper. Because some of the works I make take 2, 3, 4, 5 years to make. So there's a commitment and a patience to that. And for me, making, and it wasn't always an intentional aspect, slowness is really fundamental to the way I see the world. So I like this idea of seasonality because that is much more in tune with the way the cycles of the planet, I think, and more about locality. But this idea of slowness within making, within fashion, within craft is really fundamental to how we shift this fast-paced perspective, because in this fast-paced world, we don't see, everything's a bit of a blur because we're going so fast. And for me, making really slows that moment down and you're able to see. And that's the really exciting element around hand processes and hand making. And I think I'm not trying to be an activist with slowness at all, but I do think that I'm trying to reclaim my time a little bit, that actually by sitting and sewing, my hands are busy away from my phone, who are mining me for information and my data. And actually by making things with my hand and stitching, you know, most of the time at night, I'm reclaiming my time and my attention.
Amazing. Maria, I'm going to come back to the majesty of time.
I was going to say, I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah, I think slowness is so important. And, you know, I suppose I started out on a sort of more traditional fashion trajectory and found the same thing about, gosh, 12, 14 years ago or so now, that actually the speed of the industry was something that was somehow not aligned with the way that I like to work or the way I enjoy working, because I rather unusually cut all my own patterns as well as design. So I design, I cut the patterns and I paint the prints. So there's a lot of work that's for me to do within all of my process. And the only way to continue doing that without going absolutely crazy was to slow it really down, to just give it the time that it needs. I think what I realized at that point is, having had a business for almost 20 years at that point, that my clients were keeping things for a long time. They were still wearing those pieces they bought 20 years ago or 10 years ago, and they were favorite pieces in their wardrobe. So I thought, well, why am I thinking of clothes in seasons? Why don't I think about it in a more seasonless way? And so I sort of adopted, it's not that I don't have seasonal design, because I do create new things every season, but it's a little bit of a hybrid now, where I'm bringing in new shapes and everything's intended to work with what came before. And certain styles continue. A pair of trousers I created, it's 20th anniversary next year, are still my best-selling trousers. So I think if there's something about great design, great cut, great fit. And because I spend so much time on that aspect of things, in the fitting and the sculpting around the body and how it feels on the body, not just for me, I fit everything on myself, but I also fit it on all my team and have their comments, different body shapes, different perspectives. The investment of time over all of those years is essentially what my cut is made of. And I believe that it's better to invest my time in a few really great products that I launch rather than a massive collection and a runway show and all of that side of things. So I guess that's my process and how it's changed for me.
I like the majesty of time. Let's talk about that. I'm interested in this idea of, you know, the touch of the hand and the product that you guys all make. Because what's become apparent is that your input, direct input into the product, is really important. And I was wondering, how do we emphasize that notion of the craft and the hand and the thought that goes into making something that is inherently luxury, if that even exists today? How do we do that? And that's for anybody.
Education. I think you have to educate the customer. You have to educate. I think, you know, obviously the younger generation have grown up with the idea of luxury being about a name and marketing and a celebrity or something, and less about the quality of something and the craft of something. So it's a slow education or re-education of those skills and the craft and what that actually means. I mean, we do it in a very slow way by very simply asking people to try things on. And when they try something on and feel how something is cut beautifully, they understand what goes into it inherently because they feel the difference.
I remember being quite struck when with all the media that you can access with YouTube and Instagram, and seeing, and I think it was Chanel did a beautiful kind of behind the scenes film of some of their couture processes. and on a quarter scale maquette. And each flower was cut out by hand and sewn on onto a pattern piece that was then cut out and put into this gown. And I just thought that was a fantastic way of explaining to people without having to go into the shop maybe and feeling nervous, you know, how do you even get to something, a garment like that, to approach a garment like that. And I thought it was a really beautiful way to really illustrate the craftsmanship, because all of us here, you're talking about time and majesty of time, and I'm sure all of us, when we're actually working with the materials we're working with, time seems to disappear. You know, I love beading, actually, and I don't know, mucking around with veils, or I like sticking my Swarovski crystal on my veils and all the little things that you like to do, and suddenly a whole afternoon can disappear, and you've kind of really, I don't know, gone into another world of looking at colour and sparkle and what have you. And I also am in a position where I've worked with Zandra, and you're happiest when you're drawing and painting and putting your colours together. And so those are actually elements that can be filmed and shown to people now in a way that in the earlier days of couture or craftsmanship, that might be a bit more behind closed doors. Or it might only be seen by a customer, for example, somebody going into a tailor, and you might see some of those processes. So that's quite a new thing that technology can help us, if you've got the time to do the gorgeous setup. I mean, my studio table doesn't actually look filmable, but you can do it like Chanel, I'm sure. Yeah.
I think that's a good idea. I mean, I think more and more we need to involve the buying public, as it were, so they really know what goes or actually goes into something. It's not just a case of slamming it together. It's the thought and then the process that's involved in making sure that people treasure what they wear and that they're going to be able to wear it again and again, or put it away and bring it out. I think that the whole idea of fashion having to change, I think that's something that's got to be changed, because I don't think the world can afford to be so, what shall I say, dismissive and wasteful. I think we really have to think about that all along, both the waste that gets made and the fact that, I mean, I think a lot is now happening with all of the young kids now going to, is it Depop and things like that, where they're discovering old things of mine and reworking it and creating new. And I think the fact that we're now on the edge of a continent, stupidly separated, I think we've got to prove ourselves and make this something that we can show is happening here.
What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think, I mean, generally, I think everything is a little bit divorced from products and production, and a lot of people don't really necessarily understand how things are made anymore. I think that's a really big consequence, not just in fashion, but across all types of products. So I think getting people to understand how things are made right from an early age, and I think that really, the problem is, of course, education and the lack of education in making, and all these sort of STEAM subjects, so where making and art and creativity are slowly being eroded. I think that's the real problem here, is that we are so divorced from everything. And I think technology becomes even more invisible, right, we understand how less things work. You know, before you could see things moving, going around, cogs, but now as technology is becoming so tiny and microscopic and all these invisible things going on around us, I think those structures need to be more, you know, more visible. I mean, it has helped with that, the sort of the hashtag, who made my clothes, right? Or, and then it's the other one, which was, I made your clothes or something like that. So there are sort of technologies sort of helping reveal those sort of stories. But I would always also question, what is luxury? Because I feel like we're being sold a little bit of a lie by a lot of really big brands about what a luxury item is. And the perception of it. And I think quite often luxury doesn't really donate high quality or thought. It's really just a branding exercise and a story that we're being sold or sort of sucked into. That's my sort of a little bit of pessimism there, I think.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah, I Anyone who knows me knows I'm quite cynical about all of it. But I mean, and that's, I mean, that's kind of goes back to the start, this notion of being honest. Piers, you're talking about Chanel. So you do see that very top end of the Chanel, you know, the couture process. But then if, as you kind of go down the tiers, you know, that process, you know, ends up being Shein or, you know, whatever it might be.
Or the Chanel keyring, the entry point.
Yeah.
Piece, you know, but it's branding, isn't it? So that's the conundrum, isn't it, with luxury, is that that word luxury has been applied to mass product at a high price and, you know, beautiful branding and beautiful marketing and all the rest of it. But that word luxury is applied, I guess, to things that are expensive and companies that are needing to sell mass amounts of product. And I think we're beginning to try and want to. Well, all of your panel here are extremely successful business people as well as creatives. And you're not trying to sell everything to the whole world. You're trying to sell the right thing in the right way for you to the right customer who's going to, as you say, treasure it for hopefully a lifetime.
I think what you just said, though, is very the fact that we really need to educate particularly people here in our country to treasure what's being made here and not all the stuff with the high branding that's coming from Europe or made elsewhere but coming from Europe, and treasure what people think with original thought here in the UK.
I think it's happening. Certainly what I see amongst my customer, and this is very much obviously at the luxury end, is that we're seeing a lot more people really understanding what that means now. And in fact, a client said to me the other day, she's from Singapore, and she was over in London and she came to visit us. And she said, yeah, what I love about coming to see you, she said, is I know that what I'm buying from you, it's not going to be everywhere. She said, you know, why would I go to any of these big brands? Because what they have in Singapore is the same as what they have in London and anywhere I travel. So everyone's going to have it. It feels like a commodity because luxury or the luxury brands have evolved themselves to become that. They've become essentially mass produced.
So what is honest luxury to you, Sandra? What would honest luxury be to you?
Well, an original product that has had thought, and it's not a mass product, it's something that's been created and that people will treasure because it's, I don't say it's totally one of a kind, but it's got the thought in it and it isn't going to be everywhere else.
Yes.
I think when you look at the work and you talk to everyone on this panel, that work has come from a passion, but also craftsmanship and understanding your own hands and how you... So it's kind of irreplaceable. I could copy yours or you could make a hat. But it's you could copy things. But I think what all of us are trying to... And not even trying to do it, by the nature of practice informing our outcomes, what we do is unique and irreplaceable in a way, I think. And that I think, is a real luxury. And to be able to... And I think that the people who buy and wear my hats, I think they... I don't know whether they'd like to talk about me, but I think they'd like to talk about the conversation maybe we've had. I make a lot of stuff is bespoke. You know, I make something... I have a conversation and we make something special. So there's a whole story for them behind that, buying the hat. There's a whole story of them, a relationship maybe with the designer and the colours that you're choosing. And so it becomes very special, I think. I think that's the honest luxury there for me.
Yeah, I think luxury maybe is perspective, right? And I would put, maybe I wouldn't think of luxury for me as a product, because I feel like it's always about a product. And I feel like luxury to someone might be just about having the luxury of time or the luxury to do whatever they want. So for me, I think what I'm worried about is that we always associate luxury with the commercial aspect of exclusivity, of expensive. And for me, I feel like luxury is time. So I think that's how I would say. And that's sort of the opportunity to spend my time doing what I want, which I feel, as the world gets more complicated, less and less people do.
Yeah.
Very much about the notion of time. I mean, I think, you know, at all, as I said, at all levels, it's the time that's taken with something that goes into a great product, because if you make a great product, it will stand the test of time, because that thought's gone into it about how it's going to be constructed, how it's going to fit. I mean, people perhaps don't realise, but if something's cut beautifully and fits, it can fit a multitude of body shapes. But actually, if you think about it, just the seam pressure as you wear something and sit down, stand up, take a pair of trousers, but a beautifully cut pair of trousers that's really cut well, it's going to last that much longer just because there's less seam pressure on that seam. So the time taken in crafting that, in thinking about that, in really thinking about it deeply, actually means something. That creates, you know, it creates that extra specialness, if you like, that is something that's worthwhile, something that should stand the test of time. And I think that I'm talking about it in the notion of a product again, but I think it's broader than that, because the idea of, you know, nowadays in particular, the greatest luxury is our time. You know, digital takes up so much of it. And I love your notion of reclaiming your time through your work. I try and do the same a little bit, because digital is so distracting. It can easily eat up hours and hours of your day. So investing my time in something that I believe means something for the long term, I think it's certainly a luxury for me to be able to do that also.
So what if it wasn't time? So if you think about what you've all been saying, you're talking about the craft and you're talking about time, you're talking about it not being product, and I'm talking about wanting to change the narrative. So we have there's a global economy that needs to exist, and a part of it exists on us consuming more and more product, regardless. The other side of the flip side of the coin is, well, you should stop consuming as much because it's damaging to the planet. So you've got those kind of economies of scale, haven't you? And then you've got this huge growing population of people, in the kind of upper middle class, who consume as part of an aspiring kind of lifestyle. That encourages more people to consume more stuff, typically. Granted, we're seeing a drop in sales on the conglomerates from the Richemont and from LVMH, but people are still consuming loads and loads of stuff. How do we reclaim this narrative around what Richard was saying, that it's not always about the product? It's with you, it's all about the person. How do we get that idea of luxury back, that is not about, you know, buying and buying and buying and buying and buying, you know, most of it's a lot, you know, not the greatest stuff.
I think the consumption thing took many, many years to build. We were sort of sold a little bit of a kind of dream, you know, an American dream. If you have this beautiful car, you're going to be like this. If you have these beautiful products, you will be seen as in a particular way. And I think we've all bought into that. And then obviously the luxury brands have realized they could charge whatever they wanted and make lots of margin and become bigger and bigger and bigger. But I think then we've got a new narrative that's come in, which is that the planet just can't sustain all of this consumption. We're, you know, I can't remember the figures. I think it's something like we're consuming double the amount that we should be. But it's not just in fashion, actually. It's cultural. You know, back in the 1950s, there were things like diners. I remember when I watched that Founder film from McDonald's. I don't know if anyone's watched this film. But the thing that really struck me is in that film, they're all sitting there with trays and whatever for the diner. And then there's this miraculous moment where he realizes, he picks up this first McDonald's in a paper bag and he says, well, where do I eat it? Oh, you can eat it anywhere. That's the beauty. And he's like, oh, wow, you know. And then we've all thought, that isn't that great? We've now got we've now got a bag of stuff that we need to deal with, as opposed to a tray with knives and forks and plates that we could wash up. But we've thought it's great, and now it's everywhere, it's ubiquitous. But it's going to take time to reverse it. We've started to change the narrative in a lot of the conversations that are going on. The customer is rethinking and thinking more deeply about their purchases. But, you know, at the same time, we are battling with something which I think has been a big problem of the price of fashion has gone down, 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 down. And with it, the quality. So it's, you know, going back to the re-education of what it means to have a great product and how long something should last, I think is really an important part of that narrative.
And yeah, I was just going to say, it's not always about fashion, which is, you know, partly, you know, but we're being sold luxury as fashion, but luxury crosses, you know, it's anything.
Well, I've had many luxury shoes that have fallen apart after wearing them three times. You know, that it shouldn't happen if a product is properly designed.
Yeah.
If it's properly made, it shouldn't happen. We shouldn't accept it at all.
But in Richard's case, he's not making a product that you wear, typically.
Yeah, I mean, I'm an artist, so I mean, maybe the art is the product, but the process of creating is not what I would call that luxury item. Because I think much of art gets branded as luxury because it's elitist, because it's expensive, that people can buy it. But I think the act of making art and creativity should not be a luxury, because creativity is fundamental to the human condition. It's how we express ourselves. And whatever economic status you might have in life, like, art is important to every single person, but the people at the bottom, I would say, have less time to even contemplate and think about art versus people with more free time. So that is the way art is going anyway. And I'm a teacher, so I teach at the Royal College of Art. I teach on textiles. And so for me, it's really important that the designers of the future take responsibility for what they're creating. And what I like to push is conscious creation. And I think it's from the UN, right? 80% of the carbon is in the design process. So really, fundamentally, that's where it needs to shift, along with changing culture and perception and educating people. But also, I think it's very niche to talk about great made products when actually quite a lot of people can't afford good products, right? Because they are on the poverty line. So places like Primark, places like that, are really fundamental to a parent who's got three kids and she's got to clothe them, right? So it's complicated, and I'm not sure I have the answer, but I'm sort of aware of the difficulty in trying to solve that solution. So it needs to be governmental. It needs to be about how we educate the future designers of the world, and also what we're doing here, but it needs to be quicker, I think. Yeah.
So Andre, you started the conversation by saying you've been in the business for 70 years. Well, no, you haven't been in the business for 70 years, because you would have been very, very young. But your first collection, it was in 1961 or 2 or 3?
My first collection on my own was
1969. So since then, have you seen, was the product that you produced defined as luxury? Did you use the term? Or have you seen a shift in the way people are describing your products?
I mean, I don't remember it being described as luxury in those days. I mean, I was just aware of, I was printing it myself, cutting it out myself, and had a little workroom making them. But it then went to America and looked complete luxury because it was in very grand stores. But what I think that I am impressed that a lot of the younger generation that come in and work for me are very aware of getting things secondhand that haven't been worn a lot and treasuring them just as much. Sort of, they know the labels and they know what they're looking for, and they're not necessarily going to shops or wherever. They're looking for things on the internet in a way that I don't know how to do. But so I think our younger generation is more aware of waste than we think.
Thank you so much for listening. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Intellect Books, and of course our amazing guests, Dame Zandra Rhodes, Maria Greshvogel, Richard McVettis, and Piers Atkinson. I'm sure you'll agree, it was an amazing discussion, very thought-provoking and somewhat provocative. You can catch part two of this amazing conversation next time, which includes some fantastic questions from our audience. Thank you again for listening. And don't forget, you can catch up on all previous episodes of the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast on your favorite listening platform. And please subscribe.